The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest on the program today is going to be Jeff Cotterman. He's creator of TriSystem Edge and director of the National Association of Sports Nutrition. And something very, very important for your retirement is, to quote the old adage from a movie set of the 1980s, staying alive. That's the most important thing you can do, because if you don't have your health, all of your financial planning doesn't really do too much for you. So we'll discuss that from someone who himself faced an absolute crisis in his own life. Jeff will join us later on in the program today. Jim will be interviewing him on the subject of longevity and maintaining that. But today we're continuing the theme we commenced last week on the show. As you well know by now, cash is trash. It doesn't do much good to stay in cash. We got a lot of listener response from the program last week. And, you know, investors are worried about returns because given where we are, 0% environment, you've heard us talk about this before, where cash or other similar instruments can't seem to earn much. It's really hard to get income today off of your investments. And a lot of people are still nervous because of the crash, which happened what seems like quite a few years ago now, but they're still acting upon that one. We're in a low interest rate environment, almost 7 years now. And what is an investor to do? Because the big question is, do I sit on the sideline? And if I do, how long does this trend last? When can I jump in? And what can I do? That's the question. So now that I've said it, I hope you have an answer.
As you just mentioned, John, we're 7 years into this trend, and a good likelihood that there's a number of forces at work here. This trend could last into the balance of the end of the decade and maybe even more, depending on what happens overseas. And we'll talk about that later in this segment. But it is possible that we may be looking at a full decade of 0% interest rates.
That long? I mean, is that possible? You'd think we'd have a turnaround before then.
People think this is unlikely, John, but look at Japan. They've been in their disinflationary environment for 25 years. And look at Europe today. Europe is going through a disinflationary trend. I mean, if I take a look at, as we discussed last week, all you have to do is take a look at bond yields, and that's what it's telling us. I mean, on the day that we're doing this program, we've got 10-year treasuries a little over 2.5%. France, which is on the verge of a recession, 1.4. We got Germany at 1%. Switzerland is less than 0.5%. And Japan is at 0.5%, where they've pretty much been for almost a couple decades right now. So these two countries, what people don't understand, by devaluing their currency is what they're trying to do, what the ECB tried to do last week, and it's been somewhat successful. And what Japan's trying to do is they're basically exporting deflation. And the result is we could be on the verge of a dollar breakout, and that means lower inflation here, lower commodity prices, and also gives the Fed some breathing room and some leeway to keep interest rates lower a lot longer than most people think. And if you listen to the press conferences that have accompanied the FOMC meetings, Yellen has come out on several occasions and said, we're not in a hurry to start raising interest rates. They may be tapering, but they're in no hurry to raise interest rates. Low inflation gives them that leeway.
Ah, so that's why Scotland wants to separate. They're going to pile all the inflation on that and cut it loose. And say, there it goes. All right, explain how Europe and Japan are exporting deflation. How does that mechanism work? I mean, they're all printing money, so why isn't that inflationary?
Well, think of what they're trying to do. By printing money or resorting to quantitative easing, they're trying to devalue their currency. Now, what does that mean? Well, if the currency goes down, that means their exports become cheaper. So the goods that they export to the rest of the world, including the U.S., that means if the dollar is going up in value against the yen, or it's going up in value against the euro, that means the goods that we import into this country are getting cheaper. And of course, that drives prices down due to competition. So it's sort of the opposite effect of the country that's doing it to the country that becomes the beneficiary. Now, this is good news for consumers. It puts pressure on goods prices. It keeps a lid on them. And a good example is what we're seeing right now with the rising dollar, with the dollar index now above 84. That's a critical level. What are we seeing? Falling commodity prices. We've seen it in the oil markets this week. We've seen it last year as the dollar rose. We saw it in falling commodity prices. That's good news for you, the consumer. It also means if you're a manufacturer and you're making stuff here, it means the input prices that you have to buy to make things is getting cheaper. So the other thing that happens too is if you're in a currency, let's say you're in the euro right now, do you really want to buy German bond yields at 1% when you can get treasuries at 2.5%? Or you're in Switzerland where the bond yields are at 0.5%. So money flows out of those countries. And, you know, think of Japan at 0.5%. It flows into the U.S. Of course, that keeps rates low here and it takes some of the pressure off the Fed. Same thing, John, that happened in the crisis in 2011, even though the Fed announced Operation Twist and the U.S. debt got downgraded. What we were experiencing that time was an anemic Japanese economic recovery and a crisis in Europe. So dollars flowed out of those two countries into the U.S. and drove interest rates down.
So, Jim, why the rest of the decade? I have always wondered why it takes trends like this so long to roll over and move on to the next stage.
Well, I mean, take a look at Europe. Europe is a fiscal mess. Even when Draghi sort of alerted the markets that maybe QE was coming in Europe, he said, we need to change fiscal policy. I can't do it all by myself. Same thing that you heard the Fed say here. You know, Europe is a moribund economy, and they need to do some kind of reform. You know, raising taxes to 75% in France, maybe not a good idea. Or how about raising sales tax in Japan and they wonder why their economy is pulled back? It's too bureaucratic. And the other thing is, when you make these kind of policy mistakes, John, you know, they take time to play out and they also take time to get a consensus to say, oops, that was kind of a bad idea. That didn't work. Let's get something new. So these are long-term trends and they take time to reverse. I mean, look how long it took the U.S. to deleverage. I mean, the Fed tried QE1, they tried QE2, they tried Operation Twist, got QE3, 4, and even then, the U.S. economy, even though it's grown at, let's say, a 4% rate right now, will probably average maybe 2.5% this year. So it even took the U.S., as big as we were and as aggressive as we were, it took us time to deleverage. So when you're deleveraging, that's a deflationary effect on the economy and also keeps interest rates low.
All right. Well, last week we discussed the idea of cash as a necessity. People need emergency reserves, but not only is it not doing anything, it's actually losing value for the most part while you sit there because there is some form of inflation going on. What are investors to do in this case? What's safe? What's not safe?
Well, as we talked about last week, you still need cash reserves. I mean, folks, you're going to have to suck it up and learn to live with it. I mean, if you're keeping money in a money market fund, you're probably getting nothing. Probably the best thing you could do if you want to keep money in cash, your best play would probably be some kind of bank certificate of deposit. That's where you're going to get your highest yields on cash and the best option out there. I mean, money market funds are at 0% and don't forget, folks, there's been a change with money market funds. They have 2 years to put in place. Money market funds may no longer be priced at a buck. If they have things in the portfolio, maybe they want a little bit longer to get a little extra yield and the portfolio goes down a bit, it may no longer be priced at a buck. It could be 98 cents, 97 cents, or 96 cents. And so that's coming. So your best bet is probably staying with the bank where you're going to get probably a higher interest rate and you have FDIC. And also remember, even the Fed is talking about bond fund penalties. What they're trying to do is put into place some mechanisms to avoid another 2008 when the Fed had to bail out money market funds and backstop banks. And, you know, the next time around we have a crisis, it could be a sovereign debt crisis, which means bonds. And so they're trying to avoid that. And so they're getting ahead of the game right now by saying, look, if you're running a money market fund 2 years from now, you're going to price it at net asset value, not a dollar. If the portfolio is only worth 99 cents or 97 cents, that's what it's going to be. So you want to have some cash, and banks are probably your best place for cash, but you need a plan to put your cash to work. And you're not going to find one asset class that is going to do all that for you. You know, for example, you're going to end up having to go into other asset classes. That means bonds, it means stocks. Now, the good news, is you're probably going to have some greater predictability in terms of the outcome and greater control over your income. And you might experience, by diversification, rising income versus falling income. John, think of all the people that went into bond funds as, okay, that's the answer in the crisis after 2009. And then what they saw is their income drop every single year as the Fed, through its quantitative easing programs and central banks, brought interest rates down gradually. So instead of experiencing rising income, as you would in a dividend-paying stock, bond investors have seen their income drop every single year. Not a good outcome.
No. And maintaining it in the opposite direction is easier said than done. Well, you're at the point right now that many people still expect a crash and or a dollar collapse, another 2008. And I have no doubt that at some time in the far distant future, well, not in the distant future, because things go in cycles, we'll probably experience that because we won't put ourselves on any kind of a sound money system. But all of that aside, these people are sitting on the sideline. And you wind up in what's called decision by indecision. And I remember from my logic class that deciding not to decide something is a decision to do something. All right. You're deciding to take a course of action, and that's to sit there. So how do you combat this inertia, especially if you're going to do it? You're probably going to be fearful about the move. I mean, whatever keeps you in the bunker is there because it has a strong, powerful motivator. So how do you overcome that?
The problem, once again, is investors are kind of like a pill. It's going to your doctor and you go, you've got a health problem. And your doctor says, look, you're going to have to change your diet. You're going to have to start exercising. You're going to have to de-stress. Hey, doc, can't you just give me a pill? And that's what happens in the investment market. There's a simple solution. We saw that. We saw people go into cash after the crash when stocks were cheapest. Then we saw people go into bond funds. And we also saw people, for example, when the Fed announced, especially after quantitative easing two, after QE2, they went all into gold expecting hyperinflation. The problem is, John, there is no perfect solution. You don't want your eggs in one basket. Whether it was mortgage bonds or real estate in the last decade or bond funds this decade or, you know, more recently in the last 3 or 4 years, precious metals. There is no one investment that's going to do everything for you. And the real problem is not having a plan. If you have an investment plan, you know your portfolio is diversified, you know the role bonds play in your portfolio, stocks, what stocks play in cash, then you're not subject to the whims of the market if the market does correct, as it did in 2011, or if you go through a financial crisis, as we did in 2007, as we did in 2000, you know, then you're not subject. And the thing you want to do is you don't want to be subject to this doomsday industry fear syndrome that really keeps you subject to the whims of the market. And as you mentioned, John, people have been predicting crashes for the dollar. Well, the dollar is getting stronger and ready to break out into an uptrend. Stocks, instead of going down, keep going up. We're in a bull market. So if you have a rational investment plan, you know, here's the problem, folks. If you put all your assets in one bucket, and let's take what people did. They went into TLT, one of the biggest ETFs out there. It's in 20-year treasuries. The total return for TLT since March of 2009 is 12.65%. That's an annual return of 2.2%. Now, if you reinvested all the dividends, you would have done a little better. You would have had a total return of 36%, which would have been roughly about a little over 5.7% compounded. If you went into corporate bond fund, the LQD, you're a little better. Your total return was 30.7%, an annual return of 4.97%. But compare this. Had you gone into the S&P, your total return would have been 165.4%, an annual return of 19.5%. Had you reinvested the dividends, it would have been 197%, an annual return of 22%. And let's assume that maybe you were a little bit more conservative. You put your money in, let's say, an ETF like the diamonds of the Dow. Your return would have been 137%, an annual return of 9.9%. Had you reinvested 174% or 20% a year. Had you gone in gold expecting the worst, well, you would have been a little better than had you been in bonds. You would have had a total return roughly of about 32%, 5% a year. In silver, your return would have been a little over 41% or 6%. The point I'm trying to make here is make an investment plan and don't operate on fear. Because if you operate on fear, had you been all in cash, sold your stocks at the bottom of the market, gone all into bond funds or gone into gold when the Fed announced QE2, when gold was on its way to 1900 and silver on its way to 50, you know, look what's happened since then. And that's the thing that you really want to do. There is no one perfect investment. And you want an investment plan that says, this is how I'm diversified. You understand it. So there's going to be ups and downs in the market, but you're not subject to the whims of one particular asset class, which I've seen that mistake made over and over again. It's kind of like asking for the investment pill. And we know there's a better outcome than taking a pill is changing, having a plan, and being diversified. Look, there's a high price to pay, if I'm making a point here, of looking for one solution and one answer. And I don't care if it's all in stocks, it's all in bonds, or you're on cash, or you're on gold. You don't want all your assets in one basket.
Well, I guess the moral of the story then is to have an investment plan, because that gives you a strategy, which first of all relieves a lot of the angst you may have in investing, especially if you're jumping off the shelf and deciding to jump back into the pool again. For example, even in downturns, bonds may go up, cash will be constant, and that would be true even if the stocks are going down. But you don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket, and you would have done all right even in the worst downturns had you been diversified in bonds, cash, and stocks. It's knowing what's going in what direction and keeping yourself in various options. Okay, so let's take an example. Here I am. I'm all in cash. I'm ashamed to admit it. I haven't been listening to Financial Sense. I never miss the show except when I'm on vacation. But anyway, I'll say that.
That's because you're part of the show, John.
Oh.
That's why.
That's why I could. I knew there was a reason for that. I couldn't figure it. Well, let's just say I haven't been listening to the show. I'm all in cash. It's stuffed under my mattress. I'm afraid to do something. What do I do?
Well, first of all, you might want to start with a laddered bond portfolio. Let's put it this way. If you've been sitting in cash all this time, you're probably traumatized, or you're a conservative investor.
I'm traumatized.
Okay, you're traumatized. Okay. So, I mean, the good news here is instead of making a half a percent or maybe a percent, you can make anywhere from 2.6 to maybe 4% if you want to stay with fairly conservative bonds. A lot of that's going to depend on your maturity. Obviously, the shorter the maturity, the lower the return, but at least you're going to get a lot more than what you're doing in cash. And if you buy individual bonds, you know exactly what your income's going to be. It's not going to go down like in a bond fund. And when the bonds mature, you know exactly what you're going to get, unlike a bond fund. Now, sure in the heck, I'd rather be making 2.6 or 4% than, let's say, a half a percent or 1% if I'm in cash. And then you're going to have to start looking outside of bonds to other asset classes, and my favorite would be blue chip stocks. And if you want to be conservative, there are a lot of areas that are fairly predictable that hold up in downturns, things like consumer staples, things that, you know, people are not going to stop buying deodorant, shampoo, or toothpaste. Energy, you're not going to stop putting gasoline in your car. Healthcare, as the country's getting older, you know, if the doc says take a pill to keep your cholesterol down, you're not going to say, I don't know. You know, I'm feeling uncomfortable about the next FOMC meeting in the market. I'm not going to take my statins this week. That's not going to happen. Utilities, you're going to still turn on the lights. And on top of that, in addition to, let's say, the income that you're going to get, if you're in dividend-paying stocks, there's a good chance that you're going to get increases each year. So you may start out at 3 or 4% on your portfolio, but over time, that dividend's going to increase. I mean, do what Warren Buffett did when he bought Exxon last November with a dividend yield of 2.8%. Exxon stock is up over where he bought it, and he's already got a dividend increase. So, you know, his dividends have gone up by 10%. And you throw in other things like, let's say, pipeline companies, MLPs, and royalty trusts, where you can get 5 to 7%. You know, by diversifying, John, you might be getting a 4% portfolio. That sure in the heck beats a half a percent or 1% in cash. That's almost 4 to 8 times what cash is paying right now. But you also could see that yield rise over time, which is what you're looking for.
Basically, you should be planning and doing something. If you don't do something, then retirement becomes less likely, and you'll be forced to either downsize or go back to work or actually forced into other undesirable options. I mean, maybe the best way to illustrate that would be to do what we always do here on the program, is to take an actual case study. We're calling this case Traumatized in Tampa. And I should point out that when we ever do these are based on real case studies, but of course we change names, locations, and everything else like that so that the real people involved are not revealed, you know, for their security and everything else like that. So, Jim, tell us the story of this case.
I want to talk about this case because it illustrates two points that we've been driving here on the program. Number one, the dangers of relying on one asset class. And number two, how things can go wrong without having a plan. And we're going to call this couple Ralph and Shirley Weaver. Ralph, when he came to us, was age 68. He had retired at age 55. His wife, Shirley, was 64. Now, Ralph worked for a pharmaceutical company out of New Jersey. He retired in the year 2000 with close to $2 million. Now, half of that was in the company stock, and the other half was in the 401k program, which he rolled over in an IRA. They moved to Florida, where a lot of people on the East Coast move, and had paid cash for their house. Their home was worth about $300,000. So, John, you know, most people retiring with $2 million in investments, a paid-for home, it looked pretty good. So Ralph retired at age 55. As I mentioned, his house was free and clear, and his assets were really divided, actually almost 100% in stocks. And you got to think, folks, let's go back to the year 2000. We were in the middle of the tech boom. Stocks been going up double digits every single year. We were in the new economy. The Fed had repealed the business cycle. We weren't going to experience recessions anymore. And so retiring at age 55 made a lot of sense. And, you know, a paid-for home and $2 million, that was a lot of money. That was back in the days, gosh, I can remember back then, I could get bond yields in, gosh, sovereign bonds were 5, 6%. You could have got corporate bonds of 7, 8%. So Ralph and Shirley, Ralph retired at age 55 to sunny Florida from New Jersey. Life seemed pretty good. Plan was to live off investments the first 4 years plus the incentive package that he got the first 2 years of leaving the company and live off some cash. And then at age 59 and a half, Ralph would tap into his IRA. And then at age 62, they would tap into Social Security. So, you know, the initial plan, and you got to remember, folks, go back to the year 2000. $2 million was a lot of money. Think of what you could get. I mean, T-bills were paying 5, 6% back then. Remember, the Fed was raising interest rates, which is what brought on the bursting of the tech bubble. They raised interest rates. Commodity prices were rising. But it seemed like good times were going to last forever. And at that time, it seemed like a fairly good plan. Paid for a home, $2 million, live off the early incentive package that the company gave them, basically 2 years worth of salary, live off some cash savings, start tapping the IRA at age 59 and a half, and at age 62, go for Social Security.
Gee, this sounds like a movie. It sounds like a great plan, you know, $2 million, tidy sum of money, you have Social Security, and the home is paid for. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, it was a plan, and it was working until it didn't. And along came the tech and the bursting of the tech bubble, of course, the recession, the events of 9/11. And unfortunately, the company stock, of which all of his assets outside his IRA was in the company stock with options and things like that. So what was $1 million in a stock, unfortunately, that stock peaked in the fall of 2000 at $71 a share. At the bottom of 2002, the stock had gone from 71 down to 22 and then proceeded to trade between 22 and 30 for almost a whole decade. Now, the big problem, like many investors, is Ralph rolled his 401k into stock funds when he retired. Now, remember what the market was doing back then. And unfortunately, you know, he suffered close to a 40% loss, he told me, in that downturn. But to his credit, he did not panic. He knew the company, you know, spent a lifetime working for him. So he kept the company stock. His dividends didn't change. In fact, they actually went up. He held on to the stock. And eventually, the stock market came back, but the company stock didn't. But at least he didn't lose any income from the company stock.
Well, all right. Outside of the stock, I mean, there are bumps to every plan, right? How did the plan work? He was okay so far, right?
The only issue was the company stock went nowhere for the next decade, but he was getting his dividends, which he was living off of. In those dividends, unfortunately, the company experienced a lot of its high-powered drugs went off patent, And so the dividend increases, instead of going up high single digits, were only 2 or 3%. But at least he didn't lose any income. And he did, after the crash, diversify into some bond funds because he wanted to tap his IRA at age 59 and a half, which was in the year 2005, which is what he did. And by then, by 2005, the IRA was back to where he started when he retired in 2000. So things went well, John, for about another 2 years. He was tapping into his IRA. And then along came this thing called the financial crisis. And like before, during the early stages of the crisis, he held on, but he couldn't handle it, especially after the events that we were seeing, you know, AIG going under, Merrill Lynch going bankrupt, all the things the Fed was doing, one alphabet soup program after another. And he finally just had enough. And in January of 2000, he kept the company stock, but he sold off all of his stock and basically went to cash. Now, he didn't sell at the bottom, so he did save himself a little. But you know, at the bottom, his IRA got down to $700,000, and the company stock actually got to a low of 16. So you can see a little trauma coming in.
Well, why the panic this time? Because previously he held on, he was able to make adjustments, but it seemed like it went different this time around.
You think back of what we were seeing back then. I mean, we were seeing some pretty scary stuff. You know, first, the TARP program with a $700 billion bailout of the banks, you know, largest insurance companies going under. And once again, psychologically, thinking back to what happened in the year 2000, where he lost almost 30, 40% of his IRA, didn't want to experience the same thing. And the problem here is Ralph was spending too much time on the internet, and he also was getting some very bearish newsletters. And if you want to think about what was going on here, you know, people are talking about a dollar crash, another depression, hyperinflation. So he pretty much stayed in cash. And the other thing, which he regretted, he took his Social Security earlier, because obviously the Fed was cutting interest rates down to zero. So now he's in cash. He's not earning the same amount of income. At least he put some of that money in some CDs and locked in on some 2 and 3% yields, which, you know, obviously is better than what you would be getting in a money market fund.
So it would seem like what happened here is that, you know, with what was coming over the news media or what you read on the internet or the podcast, this was the end of the world scenario, and he bought that. And of course, that'll really kick in a good round of angst.
Well, I mean, think back of what was happening during this period of time. In 2010, we had the pig crisis erupt in Europe, where there was talk about the euro falling apart. Greek bond yields went all the way up to 30%. You get into 2011, you had the Fukushima event, which really shook up the Japanese economy. You had the Arab Spring. You had the acrimony between the president and Congress on the debt default. I mean, U.S. debt actually got downgraded from AAA down to AA. So think of the stuff if you're going to these internet sites or gloom and doom sites. I mean, this is what people were talking about. So you can't blame the guy for, you know, this is what you saw in the evening news. This is what you're reading on blogs on the internet. This is what you're hearing on podcasts. The unfortunate thing, he wasn't hearing the other side of the story. And the other side of the story, there were a couple of things. Number one is the credit default swaps and credit spreads did not widen like they did in the crisis. So the market was telling you that, hey, this crisis is going to pass. Secondly, what was going on in the U.S. economy? The LAIs were beginning to tick up and take off. Another thing that was taking place, U.S. corporate profits were at record levels. They were growing profits. The other thing that was going on in the United States, we were experiencing for the first time a major increase in oil production that we haven't seen since we discovered the Prudhoe Bay in the late 60s and brought that oil on stream in the 70s. Another thing that was going on, manufacturing was coming back to the United States. Company after company, it was actually cheaper to produce goods in the United States because all we had heard for decades was outsourcing. Well, there was a new trend, and it was insourcing.
You know, it's interesting you mention that because what people tend to do, and here's the danger about it, is they tend to read headlines and then project them almost without limit into the futures if things don't have a cyclical nature to them. And I remember we were talking about those things at the very same time he was reading those headlines and trying to warn people about not extrapolating these trends unduly.
You know, the problem with one source news is you don't get a balance. That's one of the things that we try to do on the Financial Sense News Hour and even with our premium channel with some of the guests. I've had Bob Prechter on. I had Dave Rosenberg when he was a bear, Gary Schilling when he was a bear. We have people, we have different technicians to give you a balance. And that's one of the things that you have to do. And once again, you know, the things that we were seeing back then and why we were talking about it, we didn't see a blowout in credit spreads or credit default swaps, which told us that this thing was going to blow over. The other thing that we were seeing was record corporate profits. The LEIs were turning up. And as we just mentioned, John, oil production up, manufacturing was coming up, and inflation was peaking. And we were seeing a rollover, and we were seeing that in the regional LEIs in the prices paid component, especially in 2012. In 2013, we saw them peak in the fall of 2011 and then begin to roll over. And then, of course, what happened is the Fed announced QE2 in November of 2011, right when all this stuff was going on. You know, think of what happened in 2011. We had the pig crisis in Europe. Europe was going to fall apart. We had Fukushima. We had the Arab Spring. We had the U.S. debt downgraded from AAA down to AA. And then all of a sudden, the Fed announces QE2 after they announced QE1, which they printed $1.2 trillion. So in the spring of 2012, guess what Ralph did? He went and took 30% of his IRA money and put it in precious metals, mainly GLD and SLV. Because here we are. We were talking gold had just come off 1900, setting a record. And they were talking about it going to 5,000 silver, which had backed off to $30. They were still talking about $100 silver. So, you know, it made logical sense with the Fed announcing QE2. Oh, my goodness, we're headed for hyperinflation.
And, you know, this is so typical in so many different areas because media, for example, tend to shape a lot of people's opinions, even if the media aren't correct, you know. And you can see where he would be expecting hyperinflation in this situation. And that nervousness sets in. And there it is. That's what he's listening to.
And that's what he was reading. And that's what he was seeing. I mean, that's what he went home each night. What were they talking about? Remember the acrimony between the president and Congress over the debt ceiling debate, and the U.S. actually got its debt downgraded. Remember what was going on in Libya. Remember what happened to Japan. You know, we were looking at bond yields in Europe that we'd never seen before. You know, 30% on Greek bond yields, 12% in Portugal, 7 and 8 on Spanish and Italian bond yields. So the unfortunate thing is silver peaked in April of 2011. And then it also gold peaked in the fall of September of 2011. So unfortunately, he held on to his metals until the spring of 2013 when he sold. And when we saw him last summer, I mean, you could imagine experiencing a bear market in 2000, and especially the company stock that you'd worked for, see that company stock go from 71 all the way down to 16. You can imagine what you'd be thinking. And then also another bear market in 2008, and then you think, oh my goodness, we're heading for hyperinflation. Things are getting pretty bad. Think of all the things that were going on in 2011. You know, so then he goes into precious metals right at the peak or just before the peak. So he was pretty traumatized. The good news is when he came to see us, the stock was back up to almost 60%, almost 80% where the company had been, and actually 86% by the time we diversified out of it when he retired. So that was the good news because the stock basically did nothing from 2002 until roughly about 2013. So there was some good news there. And the other thing, even though the IRA was now worth only $600,000, his company stock, which was about $1 million when he retired, was back up to $850,000. So 14 years, John, after he retired, a $2 million portfolio had fallen to $1.4 million. So, you know, you could see why Ralph and Shirley would be a little bit traumatized after three events like that.
You can see where this angst is. You get this plunging feeling if you're watching your portfolio. You don't know what to do and everything's imploding and you're thinking, of course, then your mind takes it, it's going to go to the bottom. And it's obvious that during the time of his retirement, he went through three bear markets. There were two in stocks and one in metals. So what did you do to arrest this descent?
Well, obviously, when somebody's had three heart attacks, you don't say to them when they walk in your office, get ready, we're going to start running a marathon. And so we started with a plan, and one of the things he wanted, it was something predictability. He saw where interest rates had come down, and he didn't want to put everything all in stocks because that's where he was in 2000 and pretty much in the same place when 2008, although he had diversified a little bit in his IRA with some bond funds. So we started out and we put about a half in the laddered bond portfolio and we sold off 80% of the company stock. I mean, he held on to it for 14 years and it was back up to almost 86% of what it was when he retired. And he understood stocks well enough that even though he held on to the stock and the stock had gone from 71 down to a low during the financial crisis of 16, he never lost a dividend. And throughout the decade where the stock went nowhere, he was still getting his dividends with increases. So he understood stocks. So what we did is we put roughly about 50% in a laddered bond portfolio, 40% in blue chip dividend paying stocks. So that would increase his income. And we kept 10% in cash. He still wanted that cash reserve. You know, the one thing though, at least I've got him reading some positive things. In addition, he still goes to his favorite bear sites, and every once in a while, he'll call us up and say, you know, they're predicting another crash. And of course, you have to tell him these people have predicted 50 of the last crashes, and they haven't happened. And so what we did, John, is now we had an investment plan. And as I pointed out to Ralph, I said, Ralph, let's say we would have been in this investment plan back in 2008 or back in 2000. This is what would have happened. You would have been okay. And that's the major difference. We now had a plan, and we weren't looking for one investment. Just as Ralph had been all in stocks in 2000, and almost all in stocks in 2008, or all in precious metals in 2012, at least now he had a diversified portfolio. He had bonds laddered, so he knew what the income would be, and he also knew what the bonds would be when they matured, and the blue chip stocks, and he still had a cash component.
And what all of this teaches us is something that you've been thrumming for a long time, Jim, and that is, number one, have a game plan, but also he wasn't tied to just one asset class, so this story didn't end in tragedy. We were able to, had all the pathos of good drama, as a matter of fact, able to rescue something which could have been really disastrous and turn it around. So these are lessons learned from real-life stories. And coming up next, Jim will be discussing with a noted trainer, Jeff Cotterman, the subject, keeping yourself healthy as you age. Healthy, wealthy, and wise. Well, the wise is up to you. I guess the wealthy is up to Jim and the healthy is up to Jeff. Coming up next as Lifetime In continues at FinancialSense.com.
Well, doctors and scientists are telling us about the importance of nutrition, diet, and exercise as we age. It helps promote health and longevity. Joining us on the program is Jeff Cotterman. He's creator of Tri Systems, and he's also a director of the National Association of Sports Nutrition. And Jeff, I want to talk about moving into retirement. As we age, we get older, and we know that doctors are saying diet plays an important part with disease, and also maintaining weight and staying healthy, and also exercise. But before we get into exercising, and anybody listening to this program, there's a few qualifications that you might want to talk about, and that is maybe getting a complete physical before you embark on any strenuous program.
You bet. The American Heart Association, the American Medical Association all suggest getting a physical annually to measure your cardiovascular system. So general blood work, measuring cholesterol, triglycerides, having the doctor listen to your heart will all determine your readiness to exercise. There's a basic questionnaire that every qualified fitness professional should ask and do a basic health screening before you start as well. The leading cause of death in America is heart disease, so we want to prevent causing a heart problem through exercise. Prevent it, not cause it.
Yeah, because a lot of times we see this at the beginning of the year, people make New Year's resolutions. Hey, I'm going to hit the gyms. They join clubs. It's kind of like, I have this idea in my head. I'm going to get healthy. But they don't take the preliminary steps of maybe getting an EKG, having their heart to just see what kind of condition their body's in. And even though you may not be overweight, you may have problems with your heart you may not realize.
I think baby boomers and people in their 60s, 70s, even 80s, still make the same mistake of saying, well, I did this in my past. I'm going to do what my gym teacher, who was, you know, a World War II vet, told me to do. And things have changed over the years, even in the last 10 years. We have more information and research than we've ever had before, and still people are doing stuff that's been put out in the 50s.
So let's assume, Jeff, that you've gone, you've had an annual physical, your doctor says, hopefully, you're in fairly good health, your heart's healthy. We'll get into if that's not the case. But let's talk about exercising as we age and how that might differ than, let's say, somebody in their 20s, 30s, somebody that has an active lifestyle. What is different about those that age and the kind of exercise programs that would be appropriate?
Well, in the older populations in the 60s and 70s, muscular strength and balance are key. And those are things that go if you've been sedentary for a while. So what we've got to do is measure those things. We've got to make sure that you can balance. And we can do that with simple tests to see if you can just balance on one leg. We need to do basic muscular tests. If you were really concerned, let's say you are female, you might even want to do a bone density test to make sure that your bones are strong enough to handle resistance training. Because resistance training is the key modality to improve muscular strength, to improve bone density, and using weights will also help with balance. In the older populations, if heart disease or cancer, those are the leading causes of death for any age. If those don't get you by the time you're 60 or 70 years of age, sometimes a fall is the beginning of your demise. A broken hip, losing balance, a broken bone. So you want to prevent that by an exercise program that concentrates on stability and neurological development. In other words, can you move gracefully? Not only just lift the weight, but can you lift it well and safely? To have you, Jim, do a deadlift or a power lift is contraindicated. It probably would do more harm than good. And yet that's the popular thing right now. CrossFit and these crazy kind of powerlifting exercises are the fad. And they're definitely not appropriate for older populations. In a general sense, I mean, if you are a former Olympic athlete or professional athlete and you have the genes of Adam, then potentially you could do that, but the majority of people do not.
Yeah, it's funny because near our office on the building just above us, they have, I guess the current rage is this CrossFitness where, you know, you're climbing ropes, you're doing all kinds of things. There seems like there's a rage that comes through. Can't that cause more injury, as you just mentioned, you know, people doing deadlifts or
you bet.
Various exercises? You may not want to do that when you're in your 60s and your 70s.
I totally agree with that. I do business consultation for other health professionals, and I was dealing with some chiropractors. They went through a marketing seminar, and one of the talks in a marketing seminar for chiropractors was to set up, if you're going to open your private practice, set it up right next to a CrossFit, and you'll have a never-ending supply of patients. Because people tend to do too much too fast.
So we know that, for example, weightlifting is important because our muscles tend to atrophy as we get older. And also, it's very important in maintaining bone density. But Jeff, what kind of workout and what kind of things are appropriate for weightlifting? I mean, obviously, if you're not training for Olympic competition, if you're not going out for the Chargers or something like that, the type of weightlifting somebody might do in their 60s or 70s or even 80s. Mm-hmm. And I had a client that was weightlifting in his 90s.
Yes. So weightlifting is appropriate for all ages. What's most important is the type of resistance or the type of weight that you use and how much weight you use and how often you do it. So someone just starting out doesn't need to lift actual barbells or dumbbells. Your resistance could be a portion of your body. For instance, I'm not asking someone to immediately do a push-up who hasn't been active in a decade, but they might lean against the wall and do a modified push-up where their body's maybe at a 45-degree angle or even less than that, and just cause the muscles to do more than they're normally accustomed to doing. And that could be with a resistance band. That could be with a can of beans. So as long as they're doing specific concentrated movement, in other words, they're looking to bend their elbow or they're looking to move their shoulder, they're looking to move their hand to a specific position. The idea for exercise in this age group is to stimulate, not annihilate. So we're just trying to send a message to the muscle. We're trying to deplete it a little bit, kind of like you're depleting your cell phone battery. And then as your body replenishes itself with good nutrition, the other part, your body will compensate and the muscles will begin to hypertrophy, which is the opposite of atrophy.
Jeff, what about as we age? You mentioned there you don't have to use maybe barbells, dumbbells. Maybe you can even use your own body like doing push-ups. But isn't it safer to do machines? Because I know when you do dumbbells or you do barbells, you have to have correct positioning, posture, or maybe in a machine may be more appropriate so that the machine keeps your body in the right position.
I love machines because they track specific movement. In other words, the machine is going to typically guide you to do the movement correctly. The machine is going to have safety so that if you have to stop the movement or if you have to adjust, you can do that without fear of the weight falling on you. The problem with machines is that they're not all created equal. There are machines that are designed to fit certain types of people. So if you get into a machine that's not designed for your height and weight, that's not set to your specific resistance, and there's potential risk there. So in selecting a machine, whether you're going to look to build a home gym like you have, or if you're going to go out to a health facility, you want to make sure that the machines are designed for your age group, your demographic.
Let's talk about two other areas that I think that are very important, and I see this a lot working with retired individuals, and that is maintaining balance and flexibility. Because as you mentioned, some of the problems that we see, people have falls, they injure themselves because their body, they don't have the balance that they used to have, and they don't have flexibility. So what could be done in that area? Because I know when I exercise, one of the first things I do before I start an exercise workout is I go through a stretching routine. And then I also have balance boards because I do a lot of sailing. Of course, on a sailboat out on the ocean, you know, the boat's always tipping and moving in different directions. But I noticed as I got older that my balance wasn't like the young guys that I was sailing with.
A wake-up call for a lot of people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s is, let's say, your spouse, or you're in a situation where you drop your keys, you bend over to pick your keys up, and all of a sudden you're paying for it for weeks or even months because your back hurts, or your back got pulled out, or you pulled your hamstring, or you lost your balance. So there are specific things to increase flexibility and balance at the same time. They're directly proportionate. If you're stretched out into a position that you're uncomfortable, then you're more likely to lose your balance because the muscles are being strained. So increased flexibility will naturally improve balance. And the simple answer to improving flexibility is stretching. But if you stretch cold, you actually could cause that same injury you're trying to prevent. So we want to properly warm up, gently raise the heart rate, and that could be going for a walk. That could be just doing a little mild calisthenics. Just do some movements where you swing your arms back and forth, just gently to raise your heart rate, get the body warm, so that you can do stretching exercises. The general rule for stretching is to move in a specific range of motion or move to the point where it's just moderately uncomfortable. You don't want to bounce. You don't want to put yourself in pain, but you do want to feel the stretch and hold that position. And simple little stretches with your shoulders and your hips can prevent a world of injury.
Jeff, we know the importance of, we just talked about flexibility, weight training for muscle strength and maintaining bone strength. Let's talk about a situation where, let's say you're not in the best of health. Let's say that you're overweight, you haven't exercised in a long time, maybe you have heart problems, you're taking statin drugs, or even you've had to deal with cancer. So let's take a situation where somebody is not in the best of health. What are things that you can do or simple things that you can start out with that you're not going to overtax your body or overstress it, especially if you have something like a heart condition?
Yeah. So someone who has a heart condition is definitely not going to go out for a run, especially on the weekend. You can't take care of your exercise program on the weekend and be sedentary all week. So the first recommendation is to make even the mildest form of exercise a habit. So you need to do it at least 3 to 4 times a week. The Surgeon General says to exercise most days of the week. That means more than 3 times a week. And your workout can have a health benefit, even if you have a heart condition, if your exercise lasts even 10 minutes. Now, science says, research says that just aerobic exercise is not going to get you to lose weight, right? We've been taught that years and years and years. People have been doing that. But just aerobic exercise, just look at a lot of the aerobic instructors today. They're not lean, right? So we've got to combine resistance training and cardiovascular exercise with a good stretching program and then nutrition. So what you should start out doing is start with a little bit of an aerobic workout in the beginning, which could, for you, could be just a mild walk. All right. It could be, if it's challenging, it could be just walking to your mailbox, walking the length of your driveway. It could be just doing a little mild calisthenics, and that could be defined as putting your feet together, stepping apart, putting your feet together. But you need to maintain that kind of activity for at least 10 minutes or for at least to the point where you recognize that your heart rate is going up a little bit, right? A little bit of perspiration is good. Too much or overheating or doing too much too fast is bad. So we need to start with a little bit of aerobic exercise, and then we need to do some kind of resistance training. And you can get resistance bands at the local sporting goods store or online for $10. And that in itself is going to stimulate that muscle growth, that bone density. The key to exercise is to do what you don't normally do. So even if it's just a little bit, remember the goal is to stimulate, not annihilate. So even if it's just a little bit, if you don't normally walk and get the mail, if you do that every day, if you jog to get the mail and you walk to get the mail, it's not going to do anything. But if you normally don't walk, walk. If you normally walk, well, then walk fast. So get yourself just a little bit out of breath or a little bit taxed so that your body can respond to that stimulus and change. And that is the recipe for long-term fitness.
So you start out gradual. We talked about the importance if you're not in good health, or even if you are in good health, first thing you do is you start out with, let's say, a physical. So your doctor can say, hey, you're in good shape or you're not in good shape. And if you're not in good health, then you start out gradually. I think you talked about something that is very key here, and that is to make it consistent. So, you know, a lot of people, they work during the week and they go, okay, on the weekends I have the free time. That's when I'm going to exercise. You're probably overstressing your body if you do that.
You bet. A good analogy is alcohol, right? The dietary guideline for Americans actually recommends a serving of alcohol a day for those that are legal enough to drink, because there's actually a health benefit. There's actually research out there that the government backs that says that alcohol in any type actually helps. But if you don't drink all week and then have a six-pack on Friday night, you're definitely doing a detriment. Same with exercise. You need to do a little bit every day so that your body responds to the stimulus so that it expects you to work out. If you do something your body doesn't expect and you do it to an extreme, you're going to have an unfavorable response.
Now, what about, you talked about cardio, you know, that could be anything. That could be simply walking, it could be running, it could be a treadmill, elliptical, a lot of the machines that are out there today. What about in terms of other types of exercise? We have yoga out there today, we have Pilates out there. What about these other forms of exercise that can build strength and also flexibility?
I think they're all good, but I think that each one of them favors a certain component of fitness more than the other. So yoga and Pilates. Pilates has a lot of core strength, so it's really going to work the abdominal wall and all the muscles around the center of your body. Yoga really is good for flexibility, but you're not going to gain a huge amount of strength if you just do yoga. You're going to gain stability, you're going to gain balance, and you're going to gain flexibility. It's definitely calming for those type A people. I think that there are a few of your listeners that might be type A, but that alone is not going to give you total fitness. Just like eating a variety of foods, we've got to do a variety of things regarding fitness. So if you normally do machines and you've done machines for years, then you need to incorporate some other things so that you get all of the different components of fitness: flexibility, muscular strength, muscular endurance, cardiorespiratory endurance, and body composition. Those are the components of fitness.
Let's say that somebody's interested, they want to start a program, they've gone through a physical, the doctor says, okay, you're in good shape, you want to start out. You know, there's all kinds of health clubs around the country today. Every town has, you know, I don't know, 24-hour fitness, LA Fitness out here. They're all kind of clubs. Let's talk about getting a trainer or somebody that is very age-appropriate. I know that when I started to focus on getting healthier, losing weight, and working out, the first couple trainers I had, you know, I had to explain them. Number one, I wasn't going to a rock. And number two, I wasn't trying out for the Chargers. It was just like some of the exercise. I actually got injured as a result of what was called powerlifting. I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but it was actually powerlifting. So what do you look for in a trainer, and especially for somebody that may either, one, have some difficulties, maybe they've had injuries, two, they're older now, three, they may have some health issues?
Most trainers have an ideal type of client. In other words, they got into the business because they like a certain type of fitness, and that's their comfort level, and that's their passion. So if their passion is not baby boomer population, if they don't have experience with baby boomer population, then they might not be a good fit. So a CrossFit person that wants you to compete in CrossFit, they compete in CrossFit themselves, or they might be very skilled at what they do, but it just might not be a good match. So you want to look at a trainer that's had some history, some experience with older populations, had some success with older populations. I know that when I started dealing with the older population, when I quickly fell in love with them, there was a problem. They had been taught. They're educated. Baby boomers were known to be fit. And all of them, 100% of them, of my baby boomers had exercise history but still had issues. And the problem was they were following generic exercise programs, or they were doing things that weren't appropriate for them. So you want to find out what is a specific program for you, because what works for Jim Poplava doesn't work for Jeff Cotterman and vice versa. The program needs to be specifically designed. And that doesn't mean that you need a trainer that's going to count your reps for you and make sure you do every rep perfect. You might want that, but that's not necessarily a necessity. A trainer really helps by designing a specific program and then you implementing it. A trainer helps by actually holding you accountable to that, and that might mean being with you every workout or just checking in with you to see if you're making progress. So have something specifically designed for your body that accounts for your age and your health history and your specific goals. And then the last thing, make sure your trainer is fit, right? Make sure they live the lifestyle. Make sure that they have the authenticity and the integrity to actually walk the walk rather than just talk the talk.
Jeff, are there any certifications or designations that would qualify the person that you're dealing with? Like in our industry, we have, you know, CFP, a certified financial planner. We have CFAs, chartered financial analysts, chartered market technicians. Are there designations in terms of the health fitness field?
Yes, there are. And it is called a certified personal trainer. Now, the problem with our industry is that they're not federally regulated. So there's over 300 organizations that certify personal trainers out there. Some are good and some are bad. Some you just have to take a test and then print out your certificate. Others you have to go through rigorous requirements. So some of the main organizations that are most respected in my industry, and I've been doing this a little while, I've been in the industry 25 years myself, and I hold all the certifications that the National Association of Sports Nutrition has to offer. That's how I got involved with them. Then there is the National Academy of Sports Medicine. They are highly recognized. There's the American College of Sports Medicine. So these all have a great reputation, and you want to look to see that your personal trainer is competent and is certified and insured to protect you and to make sure you're getting good information.
Now, you've been interviewed on national television. You've been featured in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. You have programs designed for, let's say, individuals that have experienced heart disease or cancer, and you use a combination of exercise and nutrition. Now, I know exercise is important to staying healthy, especially for heart disease, but are there specific exercises and nutrition programs specifically designed for somebody that has had, let's say, a bout of cancer or, let's say, dealing with heart disease?
You bet. The American Cancer Society puts out specific nutritional regimes for both cancer treatment and to maintain it in remission. And these documents are extensive. They're a little complicated, but what I do is I'll turn the nutritional recommendations of calories, specific nutrients, and I'll turn them into a real food menu. And we've had some great success with specific cancers for people who are looking to change their nutrition and prevent a reoccurrence of cancer. My company is called Tri-System Nutrition, and the uniqueness of our program is that we integrate nutrition, exercise, and supplementation. I had a chance to interview the great Jack O'Lane. He's the first personal trainer. He's the grandfather of all of this. He was Clark Gable's personal trainer, right? He got him ready for Gone with the Wind. So he said, and he put it very simply, he said, exercise is king, nutrition is queen, together you have a kingdom. And that's simply said, words of wisdom.
When you talk about nutrition, are there specific diets? Like, you know, there's so many diets out there. There's the vegetarian diet, the China study. There's the paleo diet, which is lean protein with no carbs. There's the Mediterranean diet. I mean, gosh, go to a bookstore and just take a look at the health section, and there's like 10, 15 different dietary recommendations. Is there anything that really stands out in your experience that really works? I mean, for me, the paleo diet was something that I tried vegetarian, I tried vegan, it didn't work.
Yes. So there's going to be no shortage the marketing effort and the amount of information overload is only going to increase, and it's going to be more and more difficult to discern what works for you. And every one of the dietary regimes you mentioned have medical proof that they are a valid nutritional therapy. Veganism, or being a vegan, eating no animal byproduct, is definitely good for reversing heart disease. The paleo diet has definitely been clinically proven to reduce inflammation. The low-carbohydrate or Atkins-type program has been shown to reduce diabetes. The problem with all of them is that they're extreme dietary regimes, and they're really meant to be eaten short-term. There's detrimental effects if you eat any of them for a decade or for a long period of time.
Really?
Yes. So long-term vegans struggle with atrophy and low bone density because they don't get enough protein. Long-term paleo diet shows an actual increase in inflammation long-term, or problems with storing carbohydrate or the nutrients that are associated with grains and legumes, which are eliminated in the paleo diet, right? Long-term Atkins shows decrease in diabetes, but increase in possible heart disease because you're eating a lot of animal fat. So the key to all these is balance. I think they all have valid points, and I think that they all are appropriate for certain specific conditions, but the science is equivocal. For every research study that comes out, there's a pro, there's a con. So the solution is to eat with balance. That means, just like exercise, eat in phases. And if you're going to cut down on protein or animal protein or eliminate it for short term, I think you need to reintroduce it. If you're going to cut down or eliminate legumes or grains, you need to reintroduce it so that you have a variety in your diet so that you don't unintentionally eliminate specific nutrients that we know to be good or those that we haven't even discovered yet. I mean, there's so much about nutrition we still don't know. So eating with variety and balance is the safe bet, and that's what we do when we write our menu program.
How do you do that? I mean, isn't there one type of, is it a Mediterranean diet? Is there any diet that you have found in your experience that keeps things in balance? Like, let's say, whether you're a vegetarian or you're on paleo, which is lean protein and carbs or vegetable-type carbs or fruit-type carbs versus, let's say, pasta or grains?
Just like just doing yoga for everyone wouldn't be good, or just doing CrossFit wouldn't be good, I don't think that there is a diet where one size fits all. I think that a hybrid or a modified version of every one of those different types of diets. I think the paleo diet makes sense today in the fact that it returns us to our basics. It says, let's eat what ancient man ate. Let's eat less processed food. Let's eat more natural food. But eliminating all dairy, all grain, all legume for years and years and years, I think is going to have a long-term detrimental effect. So you can limit your carbohydrate starches, you can limit your grains, limit or even eliminate flour, but still maintain grains and get the benefits of that program, using paleo as an example, without getting malnourished.
And let's talk about, and there's a lot of controversy here about nutritional supplements. Now, some would say because of the way we grow our food today, where we're plowing the same acre of soil using petrochemicals, that we don't have a lot of the nutrients in the food that we eat. So, and that's number one. And number two, most people do not take in all the required nutritional type food on a daily basis, where they have a balance between, you know, their proteins, their carbs, things that create minerals and things like that. What's your feeling about nutritional supplements?
An active, healthy person at a healthy body fat who is fit and eats 3 to 7 portions of fruits and vegetables a day does not need to supplement. The problem is no one fits that group. So most of us need to be more fit. Most of us have a propensity for a nutritional imbalance because of the way food is even packaged, right? So even if you get something from Whole Foods or a healthy market that is organic, grass-fed, is it packaged in a plastic where there's polymers or things that are going to cause some kind of inflammation or digestive difficulty? So our environment is such that we need nutritional insurance. And we need to supplement with valid nutritive supplements. That doesn't mean that every supplement is good. I think the market is full of pitfalls for the consumer. But I do believe, based on research and experience with my clients over the last 3 decades, supplementation is a valid modality, especially if you have heart disease, if you've had cancer in the past, because timing of nutrients can actually mimic or improve conditions better than even medication, I think, taking the right nutrient at the right time.
Jeff, have you found in your experience, is there a book out there, whether it's on staying healthy, exercise, or nutrition, things that our listeners might want to read or study that could help them? In other words, have you found something that you, in your career, you could say, boy, that's the Bible. I would have that on my shelf and I'd read it.
Well, I'm a sports nutritionist, so most of my reading is journals and textbooks. I would tell the consumer to become educated in the local fads and go back to the original research. And a really interesting read, my last read that got me into the roots of the paleo diet, was it all starts with food. It all starts with food. And they talk about a program called the Whole 30. And it kind of clarifies the purpose of the paleo diet, the benefit of it, and it kind of clarifies that it's not meant to be a strict program that is followed for a lifetime. It's designed to actually do specific things in a certain period of time. And I think that because that's the prevalent diet today in the fitness field and in the general public, that it would be a good read.
Jeff, the name of that book again and the author?
It is It All Starts With Food, authored by Dallas and Melissa Hartwig.
Well, listen, Jeff, I want to thank you for coming on the program. If our listeners locally or nationally would like to find out more about what you do, how could they do so, please?
They could reach me via email, jeff@trisystem.com or www.trisystem.com. And I'd love to talk to you or email with you.
Jeff, thanks for coming on the program. We appreciate it. All the best to you, sir.
You too. Thank you very much, Jim.
That concludes this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Hope you enjoyed the program. In the meantime, until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.